that you have looked into very heavily, but I'm just curious if there is anything of note that other people contributed that you would want to share.
I mean, some people share their experiences with travel over the bridge, and it's always kind of depressing sometimes to hear about how hard it can be to just get over that stupid bridge. There were clearly some engineers in the audience because they had some really sophisticated questions. One thing that is worth thinking about, if you're going from Burnaby onto the bridge now, there's a bunch of queuing space where you're basically just sitting and waiting. And one of the things I was saying is that you can use part of that queuing space to put a bus lane in. And one of them said, well, won't that just make the queue really long and stretch into Burnaby more often? Which, is a potential likelihood. It doesn't necessarily mean that those people would get onto the bridge slower. It would just change where they queue. They're not just on these ramps, they're also overflowing into the city. And so you'd have to design the street to try and make that work. But also, we know that when we make changes to road infrastructure, like when a city like San Francisco or Seoul takes out a freeway, when they remove capacity, people adapt, and things kind of just generally work out. They either change modes, they change the time of day that they travel, or they change the route.
What's getting in the way of a decision like or changes like this being made to address congestion in the North Shore?
Sometimes when it depends on the issue, sometimes I'll say funding, sometimes I'll say politics. In this particular situation, there's a certain ideology that engineers are taught in university that's really focused on cars and moving cars quickly and at a high capacity, and there's textbooks and there's a whole ideology around it. And what I'm kind of saying goes against some of it. It would require some of those kind of classically trained engineers to go against some of their principles, like, oh, we're going to make this queue longer. Oh, no, this is actually going to backfire and it's going to make things worse for transit. We know that that's not true. We know that there are lots of places that have moved this conversation forward. And so part of it is really just getting some of those public servants on board at the province. And part of it is grabbing the attention of MLAs, provincial politicians, because they're the ones that actually have to go to the staff and say, this is part of your work plan. You have to figure this out. And, the other thing I should just also say too is to give a lot of credit to provincial engineers, because they've implemented some really cool transit priority. I just don't understand why in some places we can have really cool transit priority and some places we don't, right? Like Highway 91 in Richmond has no transit priority whatsoever, but Highway 99 has some of the coolest transit priority in the region. There's a system of special signals that indicate when a bus is coming through the lane, and there's a special stop at Steveston Highway that is really nicely designed. Like there's signals that allow the bus to rejoin traffic. It's exquisite. But so I just want them to extend that to other highways in the region.
You had mentioned that, the solution to an issue such as this, a bridge that is famously as congested as the as Second Narrows, is not for there to be a third bridge, not there for there to be more lanes. And you touched on that a little bit at the beginning of this interview, but I guess I would want you to explain that more for those
Sure.
who may, I guess, want a third bridge.
Yeah, no, and that's logical, right? Like the story that we're told, and I think it just makes logical sense. If you have congestion on a highway and you want to get rid of that congestion, the answer that's always presented to us is to put more highways, either widen the highway we have or add a new one. But we can look at the places that have followed that logic. And we go to them and we look like, hey, did they actually solve traffic? Like by adding highways, did they solve the problem? And the answer is always no. We can look at Los Angeles, we can look at Houston, we can look at Montreal, like places that widen highways and add highways. They might get some relief in the short term, but in the long term, you are giving a big signal to residents in that neighborhood, like, drive more, like go out and get a car. You should drive to wherever you're trying to go. Because ultimately in transportation, what you invest in is what people use. And in North America, we've just spent so long investing in this kind of infrastructure, wider highways, more highways, and we've had some really bad outcomes. So there's like, you know, it's not that new. Like I think in 20 years old, a paper by Duranton and Turner, who are actually economists, and they've studied, you know, places all over the world and determined that for every additional, like a 1% expansion in road space, you get a 1% expansion in driving, people driving. And like, if it were one-to-one, that would actually be kind of okay, like not great, but it's certainly not, like it doesn't solve the problem, it just stays neutral. But what that means in practice is that, okay, you've got all this new space on the highway. Like imagine, you know, you add extra lanes to the Second Narrows, and so that highway is flowing faster, but then you have to get off the Second Narrows, right? Like you have to either take Main Street or Mountain Highway or Lynn Valley Road to get into the neighborhoods. And so you're putting 1% more cars through those streets too. And then you just keep going, and you know, another percent here, another percent there, onto roads that can't be expanded. And then you end up with gridlock in the neighborhoods. So I'm, you know, pleading with North Shore residents basically to think about it in those terms, to think about like if you, there will be unintended consequences if you get a new bridge on the North Shore and you're really not going to like them, because it's ultimately going to eliminate what people like about the North Shore, like nature, right? Quiet, trees, hiking, adding more cars to the equation is going to detract from all that.
Once again, that was our conversation with Movement YVR's executive director, Dennis Agar, on the Jane's Walk that they held recently on May 3rd, titled The Solution to North Shore Traffic. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This interview would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Remember, anything you hear on CJSF, we'd love to hear your comments on it. You can send us a message to our text line, 778-782-2573. Maybe you think we should be doing another bridge to the North Shore or more accommodation for cars. Or maybe you think there should be a SkyTrain that gets to the North Shore somehow to directly link the North Shore to the rest of Vancouver. If you got something to say, give us a shout at 778-782-2573. That's 778-CJSF. Time now for Gardening with Embark. And then Peter's here. What do you got to say this week?
Al Gore's coming Friday, May 22nd. David Suzuki is going to be 90, and Jane Fonda is coming too. And a few other of the minor Canadian celebrities, too.
And you have something to say about that?
About both of them.
Awesome. Okay, well, that'll be coming up right after Gardening with Embark. Joining me in the studio now for Gardening with Embark is Pablo Vimas, our gardens expert.
Hi, morning.
Good morning to you. So we're, what are we, week 19 now?
Yes, I kind of have lost track with the last few days being so warm and we need to do some extra watering. Kind of lost track. But yeah, last week we were talking about how hot it was, how we expect to have a hot summer. And this week has been a completely opposite. When the temperature dropped.
Yeah.
And today is kind of drizzling out there in the garden.
But still really hot a few days ago, until just a few days, and then very quickly.
Very quickly switched, yeah. So that's interesting because the plants as well are reacting to this change of weather. So we usually have, at this time, we'll be harvesting all our cold crops, leafy greens, and some of our griffin leaves can go into flowers. So you in the garden might notice that spinach and arugula are two kind of crops that they don't like hot weather. So it's rather than wait that the plant spends all their time or effort growing a seed, it is the time to start harvesting.
Right. Well, sort of a reminder, because we talk about the weeks and stuff you know, as a tool to sort of know what to expect. But ultimately, it's the weather and what the plants themselves are doing that has to be our ultimate guide.
Yes, yes. Just you have to keep an eye on the plants. As I always suggest, visit your garden at least once a week,
yeah,
so you can see how the plants are doing. And then the plants will behave according to the weather and respond to the weather conditions. We use the weeks more as a overall planning exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that week 21 is an awesome week because we have the weekend, long weekend of May,
yeah,
and that is kind of the official start of the gardening season. Yeah. But we've been talking about quite early, the beginning of March.
Yeah.
So if you're thinking, oh, I'm waiting for my long weekend of May, yeah, that's your season, and you will go all the way until the end of October.
Mm-hmm.
But we keep the weeks for our planning. For instance, week 21, and there's week 26 when we start our nursery for the fall already.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's why we keep talking about weeks. So this week, as I mentioned, this change of fluctuation of climate, the plant responds to that. So it's time to make sure that we know how to harvest. The most important is that we group the plants in two groups, one above ground, and we harvest that separately for everything that grows in the ground as well, and we keep them separately. So if we harvest at the moment, radishes are coming nice, the turnips are forming, we planted carrots, they are just kind of showing the leaves. But radishes, you harvest, you pull, and every time that you pull, some soil come with it, yeah, with the radish. And so you collect all the produce in one container,
mm-hmm,
that is only used for harvesting, not a container that has been used for transporting, for other gardening tasks like transporting manure or
right,
creating your own fertilizer. No, it has to be something that is clean and comes to the garden only for collecting the harvest. And in another container, you collect all the leaves. So you pinch your leaves or the spinach, you pinch the leaves or the arugula, and that you collect in a different container. So mm-hmm, that prevents cross-contamination,
yeah,
because when you pull, when you lift a root vegetable, soil comes with it. And in the soil, of course, we have bacteria and fungi, and mm-hmm, some of them, if we have added compost, as we've been doing, adding compost, adding manure,
yeah,
there is some E. coli in there that we don't want that transfers to the leaves.
Yeah.
So keep it separately. And the other thing is to use clean water. I know that it's easy to say, but sometimes depending where you are, you might not have clean water, but try to use clean water. I won't suggest to use rainwater, water that you have collected in your rain barrel. That water is not suitable for animal consumption,
yep,
neither for washing your vegetables or people consumption. So don't use that.
Yeah, you use picking that up all the stuff that's coming off a roof or whatever,
yes,
right?
So you just use for watering your plants, but not for washing your vegetables.
Yeah.
So use tap water, running water, clean water. And the water has to be not too cold, mm-hmm, and not too hot. Here in SFU, we have the hoses connected to the water system. And in this period where there are no students, we are in kind of a break between semesters,
yeah,
the water is not being used. So right, the cold water is sitting in the building and getting warm. So every time that we go to the garden and try to water, and the water is just warm, like,
yeah,
what happened? And it's because nobody is using in the building. So we let that water run a bit till it gets cold. So use the water at the air temperature, at room temperature, and then as you do your washing, and the water gets a bit colder and colder as well.
Yeah.
So, and just make sure that you have your separate containers for each part of the plant.
Excellent. So once you're harvested stuff, how do you store it?
Yes. Yeah, so that's the other thing. You can store it. So the fact that is we want to reduce the rate of respiration for all the plants.
Yeah.
So that rather, so by reducing the temperature, the plants kind of slow down their breathing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we put all the lettuces and leaves in the refrigerator. The same with the root vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you want to keep your root vegetables for a little longer,
yeah.
For instance, radishes you can eat straight,
yeah.
But they say carrots. You, what we do is we just don't wash the soil from the carrot. So mm-hmm. you just pull the carrot from the ground and you keep that covered on soil as it is.
Yeah.
And we don't put it in the refrigerator. We just keep it at room temperature.
Right.
And this stays okay. This stays okay, at least for a week. Yeah. That's very interesting.
Right.
Yeah. But the moment that you wash it and then you put it in the refrigerator, you have to consume quietly.
Right.
Yeah. So that's...
And when you're putting things away, does it matter? Because you're washing them, so they're all getting wet. Is it a problem if they're wet when you put them away?
Yeah, it could be a problem if you put close to the walls or the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it freezes and it gets spoiled.
Yeah.
So it's better to put, if it's wet, put it in the middle of the refrigerator inside, yeah. Not next to the walls because sometimes close to the top as well. And they just by touching these cold walls, they get frozen. So here in SFU, we don't have the luxury to have a refrigerator to store the produce. So what we do, we harvest, we wash it, and we share with the members of the community straight. So everybody who comes to our garden or to the community fridge that we have here, or at the moment we are not running the food rescue program, but usually we also distribute to the food rescue program.
Right. So one of the reasons we had the hot weather and it caused some of the plants to start going to seed. What should people be looking for to see that's happening and they need to take some action?
Yeah, so make sure the plants will start showing where the flower stem. So that you have to keep an eye. Yeah. Because at the moment that the plant is making a flower bud, is just switching from making leaves that we are interested to eat into putting all the effort into make a flower, pollinate, and make seeds.
Yeah.
And there are some cases, like for instance in lettuces, the lettuce becomes very bitter.
Mm.
And most of the leaves as well turn into nice sweet into a bitter plant, so a bitter taste.
Yeah.
So that's why we had to keep an eye. You can let it grow, but if you like a bit bitter leafy greens, that's all right. But in our case, the moment that we see the flower bud forming, immediately we harvest as much as we can and let it grow another week, and then we will remove the whole thing.
Right. Because
we are using an intensive system. So once we harvest the leaves, remove, add a bit of compost, and replant a new crop.
And it sounds like it's important to move pretty quickly when you start seeing that.
Yeah. You cannot wait. You cannot say, I'm coming next week. But next week, the flower is already open and formed. And you're like, it's too late.
Right.
Yeah, so you have to do immediately, take action immediately. Don't say, I'm next week. Very much when we are with the students, I encourage them, like, try to read what the plant is telling. How to read, like, the plant sometimes is telling me, harvest me, I hear, just harvest me.
Yeah.
And you have to take action on that. So just harvest and eat, enjoy, or share, as we do.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, that's some great tips and stuff people should be looking, keeping an eye on their garden starting now.
Yes, some onions that well that you have planted over winter, they might start as well having the stem, the flower stem, so it's just time to start keeping an eye how the flowers, and chives. The chives as well is telling us, because the chives are into flower at the moment, the onion chives. And so that's as well a telling that, the garden start to change.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, Pablo, for all these tips. Pablo Vimas of Mark Sustainability. Pablo joins us every week to talk about everything gardens.
That's right. And I would like to give a thank you to our listeners today.
Yeah.
Happy that you follow us through our social media channels. Yeah, as a part of Embark, as a member, part-time member of staff, we do lots of activities regarding to food justice and mm-hmm. climate equity, and you can see what our activities are through our website, Embark Sustainability, or through our social media channels at Embark Sustainability.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Pablo. Pablo and Vimas of Embark. See you next week.
See you next week.
Coming up later on CJSF, well, in about 10 minutes is Democracy Now! And up at noon is Wandering Rhythms. And you can catch up at 3 p.m., typically Tuesdays, plus more great shows here on CJSF, including The Metal Meltdown, Wire and Nerve, and more this evening on CJSF. Peter Arich is here. And what are you going to talk about with us?
Well, not just what's going to happen. Not this Friday, the Friday after that. May 22nd, David Suzuki's going to be 90 years old.
And they're having a big birthday party.
Yeah, and it only costs you $250 or a bit more to get in. And they're going to have the two big people, Jane Fonda and Al Gore, are going to be there.
Right.
So I'm going to say quickly about Jane Fonda. Jane Fonda was originally a supporter of Jim Jones, infamous for Jonestown, where all those supporters killed themselves.
Right.
Not from Kool-Aid. That's sort of a urban legend. It was some concoction of grape juice or something.
Yeah.
But actually, on the week that it happened, the massacre, there was in San Francisco going to be this major banquet for Jim Jones, on behalf of Jim Jones, and it got canceled.
Right.
And actually, a lot of the mayor of San Francisco at the time was a supporter of Jim Jones. A lot of the California establishment was actually for Jim Jones, mm-hmm. actually. And there was a bit of a connection. You heard of Harvey Milk. Harvey Milk was an older person.
I think he was the first
homosexual one.
But counselor and... I don't know, I can't remember if you
anyway, there
in,
was
in San Francisco.
Yeah, there was actually support from the Jim Jones Institute or whatever it was to help get Harvey Milk elected, supposedly. But anyway, so be it as it may. So that's sort of Jane Fonda's background. Now,
Al Gore is going to be there.
Al Gore will be here. And, the other thing is that... in 1988, David Suzuki wrote an autobiography, Metamorphosis, I think it was called.
Right.
Not one mention of climate change in it. I haven't read the whole thing, but I went through it just to see it.
Did they use some other term, global warming or something?
No.
Because, of course, we used to always call it global warming. And that sort of fell out of favor, partly because it's not exactly... It's easily misunderstood, and people go, well, it's colder. And it's like, well, it's more, what's going on is more complicated than that. Anyway, go ahead.
But there is no mention of it. And Adam, who's been audio taped on this show a few times,
Adam, what's his last name?
Tendowski.
Yeah.
He says that, they were more concerned with the arms race. There was still the Cold War. And I don't know. Anyway, so be it. Now then, I'm going to do a bit of a quotation here from this on the internet here. And they're pretty sympathetic towards an inconvenient truth. We have it's the 20th anniversary of the film. They say, well, it's an important film, but I'm going to quote directly here. That's not to say that an inconvenient truth got everything right. He was a bit over the top in depiction much of Florida sinking beneath rising waters. This will take centuries, and again, the model used was the most pessimistic. And also, a recent Science News article highlights some other points in the film that scientists might revise today. For example, the movie used horrifying footage from 2005's Hurricane Katrina and suggested that climate change was the cause of frequent and most intense hurricanes. But since then, human frequency has actually decreased, and storms intensity hasn't yet grown significantly. And also, maybe just to get it a bit quicker here, there was about the film predicted within a decade there would be no more snows on Kilimanjaro, and there's still snow there. So that's basically it. The film has had a few, as I said, they're generally very sympathetic to the film and Al Gore, but you know, he did sort of do a few things that were a bit. And there is the money, and we actually brought this up. I brought it up, and I wish that Stephen Fan was here, because we went over
the
how much money he's made. Al Gore has earned tens of millions, potentially over $100 million, from Generation Investment Management, mm-hmm. the sustainable investment firm he co-founded in 2004, which manages roughly $25 to $36 billion in assets. Now, a few weeks ago, Stephen Fan had some reason to.
Yeah.
Not so much justify it, but he had some sort of other.
Well, you know, I mean, I would say that he's running an investment fund, and from what I understand, it's an ethical or environmental investment fund. So, you know, unlike a lot of investment funds, which are solely focused on, you know, maximizing, you know, growth and stuff of the fund, while many of them are great for the people who run the fund because they get a 2% cut, not of the growth in the investment, but of the principal in the investment. So they're winning no matter what. That's a lot of money. And so, you know, someone like Al Gore, you know, there is a place for running an ethical or environmentally oriented investment fund that's only, you know, let's say not investing in fossil fuel projects. Or fossil fuel companies, is investing in other things that are more, you know, environmentally beneficial. So they might be investing in green tech and things like that. It gives people a place to put their money, their savings, their retirement stuff, without feeling like the only option is to give it to the big banks and invest in oil companies.
But weren't they doing carbon credits, like saying you could pollute if you...
I'm not sure about that.
Okay, but that's an okay. I should.
So they're all coming for a party in a couple
yes,
of weeks.
Yes, and it only costs you $250 or more.
So are you going to be going?
No, I'm not going. I might protest it. I'll see what happens.
We'll see. Maybe we'll see if we can get one of our CGSF reporters to attend and see what it's like. That's pretty much the end of our show for today. Thank you for tuning in. Thanks, Peter, for dropping by.
No, actually, what I did, I heard I was going to be on time, but I want to hear an entire interview with Al Gore that was done a few weeks ago. Didn't get much out of it, but I'm late because I heard it.
Doing your research.
Yes, that wound up not to yield much.
Right. Well, thanks for tuning in today. This will be posted up on our website later this afternoon if you want to check out any of these segments again. Remember, if you have some feedback or commentary or a question or anything you want to say about things you hear on CGSF, send us a message on our text line at 778-782-2573. Pops up right here in the studio. We see it right away. Maybe we incorporate it into the show, or maybe we use it as something to bring back to the program next week or in future shows, or maybe you can just tell us you hate what we did and something like that. Although I hope you don't use any foul language, please. That's our show for today. Democracy Now! Is coming up in about 15 seconds. Wandering Rhythms up at noon, typically Tuesdays up at 3. This program, Speak Up, will be back tomorrow morning with Danny Nesvadarani in this chair at 10 a.m. sharp. So stay tuned in for that again, and thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.